ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
One of the most ambitious projects in human history.
It's almost like the atomic bomb in terms of its transformational effect.
For decades, the breakthrough has been just around the corner.
That would bring our financial markets and electronic commerce to a grinding halt.
Will quantum computers change everything? I'm Jacinta Bowler. Binge the whole series now. Search for Science Friction, Dead and Alive, on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal land. I'm David Marr. Sorry to disappear for a couple of days last week. I'm a man. I had a cold, so it was life-threatening. Thank you, Tracy Holmes, for coming again to the show's rescue. You're terrific. The island of Cyprus has been a place of bitter division since the 1970s, when it split into two republics. Though every attempt to reunify the country has failed, the Secretary General of the UN, Antonio Guterres, was on the island last week to signal the start of fresh efforts to bring Greek and Turkish Cypriots back together, to Cyprus later. The world may be turning against butterfly collecting, but we're here to celebrate this innocent pursuit and visit Nairobi and a collection of butterflies that's thought to be the greatest in the history of the world. But first, to Anna Henderson, Chief Political Correspondent with SBS, who spent the last few days in Arnhem Land at the annual Garma Festival. Anna, I love the hat.
Look, you've really got to be sun protected out there. That heat and that light can be very damaging to the skin, David. But the hat was extensive in its brim, and I'm very proud of it.
You look damn fine in it, madam. Now, Noel Pearson was back at Garma for the first time since The Voice.
He was, and he was in a very reflective mood, and he was looking back at the failed referendum, and he was talking about how it felt for him as a personal failure, but he was also looking forward as well, reflecting on what he thinks is the next step, particularly for the remote Indigenous communities that he pointed out almost exclusively voted for a voice to Parliament, an Indigenous voice to represent those remote parts of the country. He wants to see change, and he unfolded what he sees as the need to essentially dissolve state and territory Aboriginal affairs departments and ministers, and for everything to be administered at a Commonwealth level. He pointed to, for example, that states and territories can decide if they spend the federal money that they're provided, whether it's closing the gap or otherwise, on either education or detention. He thinks that the Commonwealth should have that money, administer it, and have a very clear closing the gap focus in how they administer it. And that would be a major change to the way this functions under federalism right now.
Yes, he said in his statement, the Commonwealth provides much of the funding, while the states and territories control many of the systems through which it is spent. What can you do if your state chooses to spend it on detention over education? But his assumption is that policy coming out of Canberra is going to be more sensible, more thoughtful, more effective than policy coming out of state and territory capitals. But why is he certain of that?
I think what he pointed to was the duplication. He has always been raising concerns about the way Indigenous affairs is funded and whether or not it gets to the people who need it. And he's talking about the fact that at the moment, if you have federal levels of departmental and ministerial decision making, which then flows down to state and territory levels, not only does it not necessarily go to the areas the Commonwealth may have really earmarked it for, but it also means there's another whole level of administration, of public service, of decision making, of legislation that he's kind of put a question mark over, whether that's doing the best for the remote communities that, as he said, remain incredibly impoverished, that have, you know, very high rates of child and adult incarceration, child removal from communities, and the health impacts as well. So this is a pretty significant proposal from Noel Pearson, someone who has been very quiet since the failed referendum, to choose this moment to put forward a different path. And I guess it's now up to the federal government and to the states and territories to respond and for them to explain why what he sees as this duplication should be necessary going forward.
I know it's a bit early to see what those responses are going to be. And clearly the Commonwealth has the power to take over all of these areas. But the political brawls to remove them entirely from the supervision of Queensland and the Northern Territory, Western Australia, that'd be massive political brawls.
And I haven't gone through the kind of legal detail of this to understand whether it is actually possible for a Commonwealth to take over from states. I think it's a lot more potentially easy with the territory for the government to step in or to, you know, change the way it administers the funding. But with the states, I'm not as clear on that. And I don't know how many of the different jurisdictions have yet put forward any response because I have been kind of in the world of the announcement, not the reaction yet. But I think we haven't seen statements come out independently from other levels of government in response to what he said. And perhaps that speaks to the fact that, you know, once again, in this portfolio area, we're going to need to go back and demand these answers and demand responses. They're not necessarily just easily forthcoming from all these jurisdictions. And I think the other thing, David, is, you know, when it comes to things like policing, to jails, to education at a kind of state and territory level, it would be a massive overhaul of the way things are currently structured. And I think quite challenging to see realised.
Yes, it's not clear from his proposal whether he's in fact saying that police, education, etc., would go over to the Commonwealth. It's only Aboriginal affairs. But then what is the definition of that? Meanwhile, Anna, Noel Pearson is saying there should be one authority in the whole of the Commonwealth to deal with Aboriginal affairs. But at the same time, the Northern Land Council looks as though it may now be breaking up.
This is another interesting development, which at the same time, Noel Pearson in his address at Garma was backing, which is the idea that the northeast of Arnhem Land, which is very remote from Darwin, it has its own local, what's called Dilak Council, where the clan leaders from the area combine forces to make decisions for their communities. He's backed the idea that was put forward by local Gumatj leader Jawa Yunupingu to see that region split away from the very powerful Northern Land Council, which is heavily involved under legislation in making decisions about, you know, industry, economy, new ventures, whether they be mining or otherwise. He's proposed that the northeast of Arnhem Land split away with what he's called the Dilak Land Council, which would be a major move because that area of northeast Arnhem Land and the previous leadership out there have been heavily involved in the Northern Land Council and in fact have at times run the Northern Land Council. But the argument Jawa Yunupingu made was that his elders, who some of whom have passed on, really wanted to eventually see that autonomy and control from the local clan leaders. The challenge is those clans don't always see eye to eye. They don't always agree, and there are kind of long-standing and acrimonious grievances. So whether they can all come together to put forward a proposal which would have to be signed off by the Minister for Indigenous Australians, Mulindiri McCarthy, is something that is really yet to be clarified.
But, Anna, some of those clans immediately said, we don't want to have anything to do with this. And perhaps you should explain to listeners how enormous the Northern Land Council is.
It is a huge and powerful body which does, through a centralised decision-making process, make a lot of decisions about very significant proposals, whether they be for big industrial ventures, whether they be for making claims around title, handing land back to Indigenous communities. And they have been been the body which has made the decisions for that area of Arnhem Land. And so this would be a major, I guess, cutting of ties.
For whose benefit?
But also,
this is a powerful land council. It has shaped the conduct of Indigenous affairs across Australia. It's produced some of the great leaders of the Indigenous world. For whose benefit would it be to chop off the northeastern tip?
Well, let's remember that there are already separate land councils in the Northern Territory. So the Northern Land Council is, I think, by far the most powerful in the north particularly. There's also the Central Land Council in Central Australia. The Tiwi Islands have their own land council now as well, and there's also the Andaliyakwa Land Council too. So there are four separate land councils in the Northern Territory. But at the same time, you know, the argument from Jawa Yunupingu is that it was always the eventual intention of the leadership in Northeast Arnhem Land to make their own decisions and to potentially form this grouping. But as you say, Wanyibi Marika, who is the leader of the Ruatingu clan, which has just been handed back eventual ownership of Nhulunbuy, the nearest township there. He has immediately said that he felt ambushed by this in an interview with ABC and that it's not something that they want to entertain. So it's put the minister in a really challenging situation. She was at the Garma Festival. She was in the audience to hear this appeal for a separate land council. And then she now has the legislative power to decide whether or not that should go ahead. And quite clearly, at the moment, there isn't the agreement amongst the clan leaders for that to happen. And she will have to, as someone who grew up in Arnhem Land herself, try to decide what the best approach is from here. It does fold back, though, David, into the discussion around the failure of the voice referendum, because that referendum was designed to give Indigenous communities a voice to the federal government. Now, Jawa Yunupingu is saying, we want to have a different way of our voice being heard, and by our particular area of Australia having a clear voice just for our community.
It just sounds like a power play, doesn't it, Anna?
I think it will be read in different ways. I think we have, you know, 13 clans form the Dilak Council. We're yet to hear from all of them. And my experience in Indigenous affairs is some of these groups will take quite some time to deliberate over their responses. But the early signs suggest that this is not something which has been sewn together and agreed upon in advance. It's sort of been announced from the podium, and people are not A, quite sure of what it'll mean, and B, quite sure of whether or not they want anything to do with it.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Anna Henderson, who has been to Garma, and we're talking about Garma. Now, in the aftermath of the death of Kumanjayi Little Baby, the Northern Territory has made some fundamental changes to child protection legislation, quickly went through Parliament a fortnight ago, and huge controversy around it. Anna, what are the changed principles?
It is quite complex, but I think when you sort of distill it to its essence, there has been a long-held principle in the Northern Territory in the wake of the Stolen Generations experience and trying to deal with the realities of remote community life and kinship and culture, to try and ensure that children are returned to relatives, their community and their lands in a case where they are removed from their parents or other members of the community who may be sort of under their care. But the country Liberal government has for a long time been saying that they potentially wanted to look at changing that principle, and they went into Parliament and did that recently. The controversy has been whether or not the argument from Leah Finocchiaro, the Chief Minister, is that we have to put the rights of the children first and the rights of the family and broader community second. But it has raised these questions and concerns about whether or not this could lead to another, you know, Stolen Generations outcome and what it means for children being potentially removed from their families and communities. There's quite strong concern raised throughout, I think, Indigenous leadership out at Garma about that. But at the same time, the Country Liberal Party Chief Minister showed up. She spoke at Garma, and she, in a press conference afterwards, really defended her approach. She seems very sure that she's going to continue on this path and that she has the backing of various groups, including the Police Association. to have this legal change put into effect. But it has caused a lot of concern because, as Noel Pearson said as well, there is a great deal of concern about children being removed from their families, and it remains a great source of pain and trauma in remote areas of really all of Australia in Indigenous communities.
I mean, Pearson quotes in the speech he gave at Garma that one in two children that are now being held sort of out of family care is Indigenous. One in two across Australia.
I think
Australia.
That was in Queensland.
Oh, was that in Queensland? Yeah.
But it is a broader issue, and it's something which is, as I said, very painful. And we have gone through processes over many years of, you know, the recognition of the pain caused, apology for the pain caused by government policy, compensation processes. And so I think that has really caused some of the...
And inquiry
the
after
great concern.
Inquiry. But... The Northern Territory government is saying the safety of the child is paramount. Mm-hmm. Whether the child can be held or whether the child can be moved to a culturally sensitive, culturally appropriate community or family is secondary. You have to save the child first. And of course, with Kumanjayi Little Baby, there were, 6 notifications that this child needed protection and nothing was done.
I think we need to separate the two issues out in a way, because while one did impact on policy for another, the country Liberal Party was already very much keen to see change to this policy, and it is a broader issue for them. But as well, as I said, the Chief Minister showed absolutely no sign of taking on those concerns or having further consultation around these laws. She has decided to make this deliberate move, and she says she will stand by it. She doesn't have an interest in revisiting that legislation at the moment.
And clearly doesn't see a danger that this is going to lead to a wholesale stolen generation situation up there.
Well, her argument and the argument she put at Garma Festival in the conversation that I had with her was that she just doesn't see that as the priority for her in this legislation, and her government's approach is to remove children from harm and to ensure they're not going back to harm. And this is going to be a continuing debate in the Territory for years to come. I don't think it's going to be solved in one day, but she's standing firm.
Now, grab your bag, you've got to head to a plane, I know, and you're flying back to the infinitely simpler world of Canberra, from where we will speak to you next week. Anna, thanks. Anna Henderson, Chief Political Correspondent of SBS. Coming up, any hope for reunion on Cyprus? For 50 years, Cyprus has been divided. The north, the pointy end of the island, is a republic of Turks, recognised only by Turkey. The rest of the island, barring a couple of British military bases, is a republic of Greeks, recognised by most of the world. Attempts to reunify the island have failed again and again, the last time nearly 10 years ago. Visiting Cyprus last week, the UN Secretary Antonio Guterres pushed for talks to resume. If Cyprus has no solution for its problems, he said, it becomes much more vulnerable to the risks that we are now witnessing in a region that is largely in flames. The issues keeping the Turkish and Greek communities apart are complex. To unpack them, I'm joined by Dr. Errol Kaymark, Professor of Political Science and International Relations at the Eastern Mediterranean University in Cyprus. He joins me from Famagusta in the Turkish north. Dr. Kaymark will chair an upcoming civic assembly that will allow Cypriots on both sides of the line to have their say on reunification. Errol, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you for having me.
Errol, who wants reunification? Do the Turkish Cypriots want it? Do the Greek Cypriots want it? Does Turkey want it? Does Turkey want it? Does Greece want it? Who actually wants it?
Well, isn't that a rhetorical question? Because despite the fact that the United Nations Secretary General makes these pleas that you've just relayed here, the sides themselves do not reconcile. So there is a big question mark as to who wants a settlement in Cyprus that is both locally and regionally, if not geopolitically. But I should say, as a matter of fact, the Turkish Cypriots have been demonstratively more keen on a settlement over time. So, for instance, in 2004, there was a crucial referendum on reunification just prior to European Union accession. And at that time, in 2004, the Turkish Cypriots had said yes to the referendum to the tune of 65%, whereas the Greek Cypriots lamentably rejected that same plan by something like 75%. So there is a asymmetry, if you will. There's one side that's in the European Union, which apparently has a lot to lose from a settlement, and the other side, which has something to gain from a settlement. But it's more complex than that.
Oh, indeed.
Because, as you've mentioned, the Republic of Turkey, formerly known as Turkey, also wants to join the European Union, or, at the very least, does not want to leave Cyprus empty-handed for its own reasons. So, as you can imagine, this means that there's not just the local sides in Cyprus, but also many other actors, including the aforementioned European Union, with their interest involved.
There aren't many Cypriots, are there? It's less than 1.5 million people.
Yeah, and I think half of them are in Australia. That's a bit of a joke, but it is true that Cypriots over time have emigrated from this island, principally to United Kingdom, but also to your own Australia. And at present, yes, it's a relatively small population, but it's really important geopolitically. You may have noticed that in recent months, Cyprus has come to the fore because of the strategic bases on the island. The war in Iran has led to speculation about how those bases will be utilized and by whom, and whether even they are a target. In fact, you may recall that back in March, there were a couple drones that actually struck the island. So Cyprus punches above its weight, so to speak, geopolitically.
And always has, which presumably is why there are those British bases on the island.
Indeed. Of course, you may argue that the British bases are a bit of a residue of the British Empire. Nevertheless, Britain held on to them throughout the Cold War, and despite the fact that the Republic of Cyprus was established. So I don't know if your listeners know, but the Republic of Cyprus is unique in that when it was established, it was not established through an act of self-determination, but a brokered deal. So the colonial power, Britain, effectively handed over local rule to the Cypriots, that is the Greek Cypriots and Turkish Cypriots, but on its own terms, along with the interests of Greece and Turkey. So the three of them constituted guarantor powers to guarantee the Republic of Cyprus's constitutional order. I should just point out that that constitutional order only lasted for 3 years, and fighting broke out in the end of 1963. And ever since then, Cyprus has been politically divided. And since 1974, territorially divided.
Let's just concentrate on the British bases for a moment, because as I understand it, one of the outstanding issues between Turkish Cypriots and Greek Cypriots is the use of the British bases for conflict in the Middle East.
Well, this is true, primarily because the British bases were not used previously for these purposes. But in recent months, and indeed the last few years, because of hostilities in the Middle East, not only related to Iran, but also another proxy war in Yemen, there have been a lot of efforts to utilize the British bases because of the logistic issues involved. And as a consequence of this, it's been brought to the attention of the Cypriots who live here on the island that it is outside of their scope of authority. So the government of the Greek Cypriot side, the Republic of Cyprus, the international recognized side, does not have the ability to exercise any oversight over the operations of the British bases. And similarly, the Turkish Cypriot side increasingly had its reservations about the existence of these bases. And because Britain seems to be less dedicated to these bases, there's increasing question as to who will wrest control in the future. Will it be the Americans by leasing it from Cyprus one way or the other? Will it be the Israelis themselves? Because for them, it's more an existential crisis, given the regional dynamics. Will it be the French? Because increasingly, they have an interest in exercising their own geopolitical ambitions in the Eastern Mediterranean. And of course, Turkey is in the north, watching all of this very carefully. So you can imagine that there's a lot of question marks about the British bases going forward, not only in terms of whether they should exist or not, but what will happen going forward.
Have the British actually given any indication that they might give those bases up?
Well, they have in the following sense. Through the negotiations in Cyprus, there has been lots of questions about overturning the Treaty of Guarantee. I mentioned a few moments ago that there were three guarantor powers to the original Republic of Cyprus. But that is the constitutional issue. In addition, there's the Treaty of Alliance, which is also related to the military installments on the islands. You could imagine a scenario where Britain reneges on all of this and turns over all of these assets, these bases, to NATO or allies as such. But for that to happen, Cyprus itself would have to join NATO. Now, the Greek Cypriot side, in the context of these current ongoing negotiations, has indicated its interest in moving in such a direction. However, as you may also know, Turkey remains a member of NATO, and it has a veto on whether the island of Cyprus joins NATO or not, in the same way that Cyprus, the Republic of Cyprus, that's the Greek Cypriot side, has a veto over EU accession, to which Turkey is a candidate member. So as you can see, there's this big problem going forward beyond British interests.
This is ABC Radio National, Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Dr. Errol Kaymak about the situation in Cyprus and fresh efforts to achieve reunification. Errol, why did things break down in 2017, which was, if I'm right, the last serious effort to broker a reunification pact?
Well, it's because it was a bridge too far. The Turkish Cypriots, for their part, want political equality. Nowadays, we go beyond that and we ask for something like sovereign equality. But what political equality basically means is that Turkish Cypriots would have a say in effectively all strategic decisions related to Cyprus going forward. And for Greek Cypriots, being the majority, this is always a bitter pill to swallow. The Greek Cypriots, for their part, they want to see the back of Turkey. They want to see the Turkish military leave the islands, or at the very least, they want to see the annulment of the Treaty of Guarantee. So in 2017, at the Crans-Montana summit held in Switzerland, those two elements failed to make a handshake. So the Turkish Cypriots were holding out for commitments for political equality, including rotational presidency, which means that we would have one term a Greek Cypriot, one term a Turkish Cypriot, or some variation of that. And Turkey was to annul the Treaty of Guarantee. As it turns out, there was acrimony. I don't know the exact details of exactly how things fell apart, but apparently, the United Nations Secretary General was unable to keep all the sides at the table, in particular the Greek Cypriot side. And so the then Greek Cypriot leader, Mr. Anastasiadis, decided that he would no longer pursue a settlement on that basis. And in fact, he confided with the Turkish foreign minister, Nazım Çavuşoğlu, at the time, that he was interested in something different, that perhaps instead of a federation based on the rotating presidency, we could have something looser than that. And ever since then, Turkey also pivoted away from a federation and has been insisting on a two-state settlement. So 2017 was an important turning point in the negotiations.
Is one of the problems about the Turkish side calling for equality in some form that they are a minority? They're, what, only about 20% of the population?
This is true. So if you think about democracy, we always have a problem with numbers, don't we? And this is why, instead of a straightforward democracy, we've been talking about a bizonal, bicommunal federation. And perhaps I should explain that to you. Since 1977, the sides have agreed to this, and this has been enshrined in United Nations Security Council resolutions. Bizonality means that in the north, the Turkish Cypriots would retain a majority of population and territory or property ownership. And bicommunality means that Turkish Cypriots, despite being a minority, would exercise political equality. So this is a complex issue. And of course, federations are complex matters. The problem then becomes is, to what degree do we emphasize the equality, and to what degree do we emphasize the demographics? And so in a federal system, we would have an upper legislative body, say a Senate, and a lower representative body. And of course, there's always tension between the representation of states on the one hand versus the representation of peoples and individuals on the other hand. And so this is why when we talk about the Cyprus problem, we often invoke cases like Belgium or Switzerland, yes, or other relevant cases from which we can glean a model for application. I think the Turkish side basically has pivoted and said that this won't work. And the Greek Cypriots themselves are the ones who don't actually want it, because the equality side, as I put earlier, is a bitter pill to swallow.
Is there also outstanding between these two sides questions of property and questions also of justice that goes back to the violence of the division of the island?
Yes, I would say that property is a huge issue. As you can imagine, for the past 50 years, the island has been divided, and Turkish Cypriots have redistributed what were formerly Greek Cypriot properties. Now, of course, the Greek Cypriots didn't sit back and take this. They applied to the European Court of Human Rights, and the European Court of Human Rights, in turn, has jurisdiction over the fate of these properties in the north. So if there is ever a reason for a settlement, it would be about how to deal with all these outstanding property cases. There are, of course, also Turkish Cypriot properties in the south, and to some extent, the Turkish Cypriots have pushed for a global exchange of properties, irrespective of how that fits within the schema of the human rights regime. Even if we went that route, there would still be outstanding debt on the Turkish side towards the Greek Cypriots. So reunification also entailed a number of territorial adjustments to accommodate a number of these issues. And that's the bitter pill for the Turkish side, because they've grown accustomed to the property regime in the north. And this is a big, big problem going forward, because even if we go the route of compensation, we're talking about billions and billions of euros in compensation.
Mm. And life on the island at the moment, can you move between the Turkish and the Greek sides? Is it an island where everyone can actually move around?
Well, I wouldn't say everyone. If you are a European citizen, an EU citizen, you can freely. In 2004, the European Union passed a regulation called the Green Line Regulation. And according to the Green Line Regulation, individuals, as well as products, can cross freely subject to controls, of course. So there is technically something like a border. From the Turkish Cypriot standpoint, it is a border, but from the Greek Cypriot standpoint, it's just an administrative line to control for customs. And that's pretty much what it is. However, things could get more complicated in the near future. I don't know if your listeners are aware of this, but the Republic of Cyprus has applied to join the Schengen zone. So the Schengen zone inevitably would mean a harder border. So the question to which it would displace the Green Line regulation is an open question. I should also point out, however, that if you are not an EU citizen or possess a Schengen visa, you may or may not be able to cross the Green Line. So this means that people who have come from Turkey and who have settled in northern Cyprus may not, generally speaking, cross into the south. Mm.
In October last year, there were elections in northern Cyprus. Do they give you some confidence that reunification might be possible? Was it a good outcome for those who want the island to be knitted back together?
Indeed. The Turkish Cypriots are a divided society themselves. Thus far in our discussion, I've been talking about the Greek Cypriots versus the Turkish Cypriots in aggregate. But of course, there's a lot more detail than that. Turkish Cypriots are internally divided. Some still hold out for federation and thus a form of reunification. And others have given up on that and want to go with Turkey. And if Turkey does not join the European Union, nor will they join the European Union. You may think of it like that. So the question becomes, what does the election of Tufan Erhurman mean for Cyprus? Mr. Erhurman won the presidential election in October of last year, and he remains committed to a settlement in Cyprus under UN auspices. And what that means generally is a form of federation. Now, he doesn't say that he's pursuing a federation. He says he's pursuing political equality plus whatever convergences the sides have agreed to over the years. Of course, convergences, to the extent that they mean a bizonal, bicommunal federation, means federation. So Mr. Erhurman remains in favor of a federation, given that, and the Greek Cypriot side also remains in favor of the BBF, the Bizonal Bicommunal Federation, where we left off at the failed Kran Montana summit of 2017. And this is what has inspired the United Nations Secretary General to come all the way to Cyprus. So there had not been a Secretary General visit to the island since 2010. So that had been 16 years abeyance. And he came last week trying to broker a deal, but he failed to do so.
You will be chairing the Civic Assembly. When's this going to happen, and what hopes do you have for it?
Well, here's a really interesting thing. This is the first time anyone has heard of it publicly, even in Cyprus. What I should tell you is that the sides, the leaders, have agreed to establishing a consultative body. That is, to democratize the peace process. And the consultative body will be comprised of a steering committee plus a civic assembly. So the civic assembly would basically be randomly selected citizenry who rotate on a four-month basis. Those are the terms of reference that have come up with between the leaders. And hopefully this will be implemented in the near future, despite the setback of the Secretary General's mission that I mentioned a moment ago. So at the present time, it's not operative. We've just set up a consultative body steering committee, but we haven't actually implemented. As you can imagine, it's very difficult to implement civic assemblies.
Indeed.
This sort of participatory deliberative democracy requires institutional setup. And indeed, as you can imagine, it would also require bilingual simultaneous translation and resources to get it off the ground. So it's not as easy as saying you want to do it. You have to implement it as well.
Errol, thank you so much for joining us on Late Night Live to discuss the intricacies of the situation on Cyprus.
Well, thank you for having me, and I hope I haven't made it more complicated than it already is.
It is a densely complex issue. So look, thanks for joining us on the show. I've been talking to Dr. Errol Kaymark, Professor of Political Science and International Relations at the Eastern Mediterranean University on Cyprus, and he joined us from Famagusta. This is Late Night Live. Coming up, an anthem to butterfly collecting. You live and learn. Winston Churchill, it turns out, was a butterfly collector. And what more innocent enthusiasm could there be than collecting butterflies? No guns, no blood, just a net, a pin, and eternity in a glass case. But, and you could hear the but coming, but times have changed. In a beautiful essay published the other day in the Los Angeles Review of Books, the Danish scholar Emil Letbiter wrote that with butterfly numbers steadily decreasing all over the world since the 1960s, butterfly enthusiasts have been encouraged to photograph rather than kill, and legislation against collecting has been put in place in several countries. Chase butterflies and you can end up in prison. Emil joins me now from Copenhagen. Emil, welcome.
Thanks for having me, David.
Now, Emil, are men and women with nets running through the grass, scooping up a few butterflies, really a threat to the species?
No, and I don't know any serious person who would claim so. I think that this turn away from collecting and towards photography, it's more because since butterfly populations have been decreasing, killing them has come to seem in bad taste. So it's much more about that. It sort of feels wrong to kill butterflies now that we know that there isn't this abundance that we're seeing all over. But of course, the real threat to butterflies is just habitat destruction.
And so you write that the question of collecting is a moral one more than anything else. It's a moral gesture not to net a butterfly.
Exactly. This idea has also been peddled a lot in the literature. I don't know if you know this book by John Fowles, The Collector. This is sort of the central work of hating collectors, because you meet this sort of serial killer or serialer. He kidnaps a woman and he also collects butterflies. So it's become sort of framed as this sinister thing that it's a thing that a lot of people used to do. Only in, you know, my parents' generation, they certainly, both my parents collected beetles and butterflies and all that sort of stuff.
Now, your essay is called The Last of the Great Butterfly Collectors, and it is a sort of anthem to this man in Kenya, Steve Collins. Tell us about Steve Collins.
Well, I mean, Steve Collins is set in the nicest way possible. He is a bit of a holdover from the British Empire. So you arrive at this house, which is just, it's in a suburb of Nairobi, but you feel like you're in the middle of the forest because it's just so lush and there are birds all around and butterflies fluttering around. And then you meet this man and his house is lined with books, sort of the type of How to Talk Correctly or Palgrave's Golden Treasury of the greatest English lyrical songs and poems and that sort of stuff. And he has the King's English, doesn't he? He's very funny. So when we were walking around on his estate, I was almost about to step on a column of marching siafu or safari ants. And of course, he just very dryly remarked, better not step in that, because if you do so, you probably have to remove your trousers. And that might be terribly embarrassing for the rest of us.
So here's a man born in Kenya and sort of living this British Kenyan life still in the 2020s and collecting butterflies. Is this something that he's done all his life?
It is. So, I mean, he grew up, as you said, he grew up in Kenya, and the interest was sparked because his parents went on holiday to the Belgian Congo to see the pygmies. And it turns out they saw a lot more butterflies and they came back and were completely enamored with butterflies. And then they passed on this interest to their children. And well, Steve or Collins, he told me that his first butterfly, his first really beautiful butterfly he caught, was confiscated by his headmaster.
And why? He kept it for himself. Why?
And Steve has been thinking about this ever since.
Making up for this childhood trauma.
Exactly. But now he has, I mean, he has the largest, just by numbers, the largest private butterfly collection in the history of the world, over 4 million specimens. So I think he's made up for that, but he told me that he still thinks about it. And he can still remember it exactly how it looks.
And where are these 4 million butterflies? They can't be in his house.
No, so he has, well, what looks like a bungalow or a barn on his a little away from his house. And you open up the doors and you just step into this room that feels like a huge library because it's just shelves and shelves. And you pull out a case of butterflies and maybe you're looking at 50 or something like that. So something like that for each case. And that amounts to 4.25 million, if I remember correctly.
Collins has 4 million or so specimens in his collection, but is there still one that he's after?
I've asked him this and he was reluctant to answer, but he estimates that his collection is represents 95% of the butterflies in the Afrotropics. So there are some butterfly collections that are more complete. So there's a guy in Paris who now is now dead. But he had a few specimens that Collins didn't have, and he was a bit of a shady character. So I think some of those have been nagging him. But he's also discovering new species all the time. I mean, every time I write to him for, you know, to get some quotes sorted or anything like that, he's like, oh, I'm on safari in Angola, and I'll get back to you in a few weeks. And I get back in a few weeks, and I how was your trip to Angola? And he says, well, I mean, it was a very, very dry, wet season, but we managed to discover one new species unknown to science, so that's pretty good.
So the journey was worthwhile.
Yeah, exactly. But so I think, I mean, there are some collectors who are sort of a little mad in their pursuit of something, a little Captain Ahab-like, but Steve Collins is a very zen guy. I think that he's always on the lookout for new stuff, but he's not that sort of hunter in the same way. He rather lets stuff come to him.
Do butterflies last in glass cases?
Well, they do, but they have to be constantly maintained. So, I mean, there's one employee at the butterfly collection who spends most of his time, 75% of his time is spent on, well, using insect deterrent on the butterfly cases, because of course you're in the tropics. So that's just, I mean, it's full of, paradoxically, all these insects that are just everywhere are also a huge threat to the specimens.
So he's peppering them with DDT and things to keep lice yeah, okay.
Exactly.
And you came to him because he's a celebrated figure in the butterfly collecting world. Is that right?
Yeah, so I'm writing a book on collecting. I was actually talking to another butterfly collector who was unwilling to actually give an interview because he felt ashamed about having been a butterfly collector. And then I saw an article in the Wall Street Journal about this butterfly collector in Kenya who is looking for someone to take over his collection because it's so unique and so precious. And well, the Kenyan government doesn't have the resources to keep it. So he's looking for someone to take it over. And then I just emailed him at his institute and came down and stayed with him for 2 weeks.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to the scholar Emil Lett-Beiter about butterfly collecting. But that's only one chapter of what is his work at the moment, which is to write about collecting. Now, Emil, I want you to be able to tell us, why do people collect?
I think there are so many ways of approaching that question. I mean, psychologists have been trying to answer that in so many ways. But I think that when you really boil it down, at least to me, it is a way of expressing a profound love for the world. Because within each thing that you collect, there's, of course, a world unto itself. But by choosing to collect something, what you're saying is, this world is worthy of my love, and I am willing to dedicate my life to this small section of it. I mean, it's as simple as if you love someone, you hold them tight, and if you love something, you pick it up, or you catch it in your net.
What if you love Napoleon?
Yeah, I mean, I have a whole chapter on collecting famous people, which focuses on, well, everything from Christian relics to, I mean, I tell my own personal story of, I have a pair of sunglasses that allegedly belong to John Lennon. And of course, I also meet with a collector who collects everything that has to do with Napoleon. So he has miniature figures of Napoleon and busts of Napoleon and paintings of Napoleon and, of course, of his extended family. And of course, so however many Napoleon hats. And he also gets this town in China where they're really good at reproducing oil paintings. They just do copies of famous paintings. So he just ordered a bunch of paintings of the Bonaparte family
and from Napoleon, this town in China. Napoleon crossing the Alps, of course. He would have
to. Yeah, Napoleon crossing the Alps, yeah.
Have you looked at the difficult issue of politicians who admire Napoleon? They don't, on the whole, turn out well.
No, they don't. And Napoleon was that kind of person himself. I mean, he liked to compare himself to Caesar, but he really didn't like when other people did it.
Well, Caesar sort of ended quite badly, yes. But now look, for you, you're collecting information, you're collecting wonderful stories. Has it made you want to have a case of butterflies on the wall?
I'll have to admit that when I came back from Kenya, I actually did a few days in Paris. And as it happens, in Paris, there's this wonderful shop called Dérol, where you can buy butterflies. And you can just pull out a shelf and then you can pick the butterfly that you want and they'll arrange it for you and everything. So I actually bought two butterflies on my way home. So I actually already have two.
What about this little-known aspect of Winston Churchill that he collected butterflies? Did he really sort of run through the grass with a butterfly net?
He did. And, I mean, Winston Churchill is a bit unique in the history of butterfly collectors because usually butterfly collectors who are politicians fail spectacularly.
Ah, so now that is an interesting correlation, yes.
There's this text by Miriam Rothschild, who was the niece of a great butterfly collector himself, Walter Rothschild. And she remarks that, I can't quite remember the names of everyone, but there was this one butterfly collector, or maybe he collected snails, but he was the cause of why the Brits couldn't use the Irish ports during World War II. And there's this line that just goes through all these politicians or civil servants who collected, they just failed spectacularly because they were dithering away their time looking at butterflies or snails or whatever, or seashells. And as she said, I mean, if you're looking, spending so much of your time looking at the trees, what happens to the forest? Winston Churchill is unique in the history of butterfly collectors who are also politicians because he got things done.
Yeah, he got one or two things done.
Yeah, I would say so.
Emil, thanks for joining us on the show.
Thanks for having me.
I've been talking to the Danish scholar Emil Letbiter about an essay of his, most beautiful essay in the Los Angeles Review of Books about butterfly collecting. And that's the show. On our next, Ian Dunt takes us to Clacton-on-Sea, a sad little holiday town a couple of hours up the road from London, where the most ridiculous by-election in British history is being fought between Nigel Farage and a man in a garbage bin, and Count Binface is in with a chance. Not so the cats of Kangaroo Island. They are all to go, not just the ferals, but household tabbies too. Why? To give bandicoots, penguins and echidnas a fighting chance. That's next. Thank you.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.